Das Thema der heutigen Abendveranstaltung in Form einer Podiumsdiskussion ist Intervenieren oder Wegsehen, Bürgerkriege und die internationale Gemeinschaft. Dieses Thema ist bereits angeklungen, insbesondere heute am späteren Nachmittag, als Michael Johnson seinen Vortrag gehalten hat, früher Chefankläger des Internationalen Strafgerichtshofs für das frühere Jugoslawien. Wir haben innerhalb des Clusters einen Schwerpunkt, der sich nennt transkulturelle Hierarchien. Dort gibt es übrigens ein Unterfeld, das nennt sich moderne Protektorate. Das zielt ab, mehr oder weniger, auf den Problemzusammenhang, um den es heute Abend gehen soll. Es ist so, dass die sogenannte internationale Gemeinschaft, wie sie dann schlankweg meistens bezeichnet wird, in mancher Hinsicht besser ist als ihr Ruf, so könnte man sagen. Es gibt eine mittlerweile jahrzehntealte Tradition der Vereinten Nationen im Bereich sogenannter Peacekeeping-Missionen, manchmal sagt man auch Peacebuilding. Die Entwicklung nach dem Ende des Kalten Krieges ist sehr widersprüchlich verlaufen. Es gab eine Agenda for Peace, so hieß die damals, 1992, herausgegeben vom damaligen Generalsekretär Boutros-Ghali. Es gab dann eine Serie von teils durchaus erfolgreichen, zum überwiegenden Teil aber wiederum, muss man sagen, tief traumatischen Fehlschlägen, was Peacekeeping betraf, also mit anderen Worten die Intervention der internationalen Gemeinschaft, um Menschen vor massiven Verletzungen ihrer Rechte bzw. schlicht auch ihr Leben zu retten. Beispiele sind die, die heute zum Teil schon genannt wurden, Ruanda etwa, Srebrenica, beides Fälle, in denen die Vereinten Nationen tätig waren und denen sie dramatisch gescheitert sind und in der Tat auch für die Angehörigen der Vereinten Nationen traumatisch, was man feststellen kann, wenn man mit den UN-Beamten, die dort mittelbar oder unmittelbar involviert waren, spricht. Nichtsdestotrotz gibt es so etwas wie ein Lernen der internationalen Gemeinschaft, auch dies wiederum zentriert sich um die Vereinten Nationen. Es gibt ein allgemein akzeptiertes Prinzip, das sich nennt the responsibility to protect, also was auf Deutsch normalerweise mit Schutzverantwortung übersetzt wird. Damit ist gemeint die Verantwortung der internationalen Gemeinschaft für den Schutz von Menschenrechten, wenn souveräne Staaten zerfallen sind, wenn sie nicht mehr in der Lage sind, selbst diesen Schutz zu übernehmen oder vielleicht auch die vorhandenen Reste von Autorität nicht willens sind, das zu tun. Ich möchte Ihnen die Teilnehmer des heutigen Podiums vorstellen. Ich begrüße sehr herzlich Matthias Rüb. Herr Rüb wird die Diskussion des Podiums moderieren. Er war in den 1990er Jahren der Balkankorrespondent der Frankfurter Allgemeinen Zeitung und Herr Rüb hat sich nicht nur als Reporter und Redakteur, sondern auch als Autor einer ganzen Serie von Büchern intensiv mit dem Zerfall Jugoslawiens und den nachfolgenden Bürgerkriegen befasst. Die Arbeiten von Matthias Rüb wurden mehrfach mit Preisen ausgezeichnet, etwa 2001 mit der Rudolf-Vogel-Medaille der Südosteuropa-Gesellschaft. 2004 erhielt er den George F. Cannon-Kommentarpreis. Herr Rüb, wir freuen uns ganz besonders, dass auch Sie den Weg über den Atlantik auf sich genommen haben, um unser Unternehmen zu unterstützen. Hans Blom wird die Runde eröffnen mit einem, was man heute Impulsreferat nennt. Lassen Sie mich Ihnen auch Hans Blom in aller Kürze vorstellen. Er ist Historiker und war bis vor kurzem Direktor des in aller Welt für seine gründliche Forschung und auch für seine Archive berühmten Niederländischen Instituts für Kriegsdokumentation. Hans Blom leitete im Auftrag der niederländischen Regierung die Untersuchung des Instituts zu dem Massaker von Srebrenica, dem im Juli 1995 zwischen 7.000 und 8.000 muslimische Bewohner, männliche Bewohner einer sogenannten UN-Schutzzone zum Opfer fielen. Grund der Untersuchung war die Tatsache, dass es ein kleines und, wie sich herausstellte, völlig unzureichend unterstütztes Kontingent niederländischer Blauhelmsoldaten die Einnahme Srebrenicas durch bosnisch-serbische Truppen nicht hatte aufhalten können. Lieber Hans Blom, ich freue mich sehr, dass Sie unsere Einladung angenommen haben und das Eingangsstatement zu unserer Podiumsdiskussion geben werden. Auch wenn ich jetzt die weiteren Teilnehmer unseres Podiums in alphabetischer Reihenfolge vorstellen möchte, so liegt doch eine gewisse Logik darin, mit Christopher Daase zu beginnen. Sowieso, aus bestimmten Gründen. Herr Daase ist nämlich Repräsentant der Wissenschaft sans phrase gewissermaßen auf diesem Podium. Er ist Professor für internationale Politik an der Ludwig-Maximilian-Universität München und derzeit der Direktor des dortigen Instituts für Politikwissenschaft. Und Herr Daase hat das, sage ich mal so, schlank weg, weil er es selbst vermutlich nicht sagen würde, das Phänomen sogenannter asymmetrischer Konflikte bereits Ende der 1990er Jahre untersucht, deutlich bevor dieses Thema durch andere Autoren popularisiert wurde. In jüngerer Zeit befasst sich Christopher Daase mit der Entwicklung von Gewaltbereitschaft in islamistischen Jugendszenen und deren Subkulturen. Lieber Herr Daase, ich begrüße auch Sie hier noch einmal ganz offiziell sehr herzlich. Und wir freuen uns alle, dass Sie von der großen an die kleine Exzellenz-Universität gekommen sind, um heute Abend mit uns zu diskutieren. Hubert Kleinert, der von Ihnen aus gesehen links außen sitzt, besetzt auf unserem Podium gewissermaßen die Schnittstelle zwischen Wissenschaft und Praxis. Er ist Professor für Politikwissenschaft an der Fachhochschule für öffentliche Verwaltung Wiesbaden und zugleich ein vielgefragter politischer Publizist. Hubert Kleinert war in den 1980er Jahren Bundestagsabgeordneter der Grünen, bis er dem damals noch geltenden Rotationsprinzip zum Opfer fiel. Er war hessischer Landesvorsitzender der Grünen und galt, wie es in einem etwas abgegriffenen Politsprech heißt, als enger Vertrauter von Joschka Fischer. Er hat aus nächster Nähe die heftigen Diskussionen verfolgt und mitgestaltet, die die Grünen innerhalb und außerhalb der Bundesregierung in Zusammenhang mit den ersten Auslandseinsätzen der Bundeswehr in mancher Hinsicht stellvertretend für die deutsche Gesellschaft durchzumachen hatten. Ich bedanke mich auch bei Ihnen, Hubert Kleinert, sehr herzlich für die aktive Teilnahme an unserer Konferenz. Damit komme ich zu Peter Schumann, der als Praktiker weiß, wovon er spricht, wenn es um Interventionen der internationalen Gemeinschaft in Bürgerkriegsgesellschaften geht. Herr Schumann war 30 Jahre lang für die Vereinten Nationen tätig. Er war Leiter der UN-Entwicklungsprogramme in Somalia und Tadschikistan. Er war Leiter der Vorbereitungskommission der Vereinten Nationen für den Kosovo-Einsatz mit Sitz in Tirana. 1999 bis 2004 war Peter Schumann im Kosovo selbst als Acting Minister verantwortlich für Aufbau und Leitung der gesamten Zivilverwaltung unter UN-Mandat. Und bis vor wenigen Monaten war er Stabschef und kommissarischer Leiter der UN-Mission in Südsudan. Die Tätigkeit als kommissarischer Missionschef hing übrigens damit zusammen, dass das Regime in Khartoum den Sondergesandten des UN-Generalsekretärs in Sudan, den Niederländer Jan Pronk, zur persona non grata erklärt hatte, nachdem dieser sich öffentlich über das Morden und die Vertreibung in der westsudanesischen Provinz Darfur geäußert hatte. Wir schätzen uns eben auch besonders glücklich, dass wir Herrn Schumann als Lehrbeauftragten gewinnen konnten und unter anderem ist er für eines der im Exzellenzcluster angesiedelten Masterstudienprogramme zuständig, nämlich für das Programm Public Administration and Conflict Management. Das ist übrigens das einzige Masterstudienprogramm in Europa, das für sich in Anspruch nehmen darf, Nachwuchskräfte, Nachwuchsführungskräfte für Peacekeeping-Operationen auszubilden. Lieber Herr Schumann, Sie sind gewissermaßen auf vertrautem Terrain, also mittlerweile hier, gleichwohl begrüße ich Sie an diesem Abend sehr herzlich und ich übergebe das Wort zunächst an Matthias Rülp.
Und ich übergebe das Wort direkt an Hans Blom, bitte.
Dankeschön für die Einladung und für die Introduktion. Ich habe heute Mittag schon auseinandergesetzt, warum ich was ich zu sagen habe, lieber auf Englisch sage. At least 7,500 Bosnian Muslims missing, virtually certain all dead. Around 6,000 of them slaughtered in mass executions. That was the dreadful outcome of the events of July 1995, following the Bosnian Serbs army's capture of the enclave Srebrenica in eastern Bosnia, which has been declared a United Nations safe area in 1993. This evoked deep emotions and intense public debate from the moment it became known in the outside world. Dutch troops, Dutchbat, were present in Srebrenica as part of UNPROFOR, the United Nations Protection Force. Therefore, the debate was particularly heated in the Netherlands, also after a penetrating discussion in Parliament in December 1995. There remained numerous uncertainties about exactly what had happened. It was against this background that the Dutch cabinet asked the Dutch Institute for War Documentation in 1996 to conduct an independent historical research into the events that took place before, during, and after the enclave's fall. That is virtually the whole history of mankind, and we were free to make our choice. As the then brand new director of this institute, I felt that it was in the given circumstances a social duty to comply with this request, no matter how hard that task would turn out to be. And hard it was, I can assure you. I will not go into the details because I have only 20 minutes for this introductory speech, but I am prepared to go into the details in the discussion if you want. This research took a long time to complete. We presented our report, which we had a staff of about 10 researchers, only in 2002. This time was necessary not only to encompass the enormous quantity of information about the different kinds of complicated interwoven processes. For instance, apart from the archival documentation, we interviewed more than 900 individuals all over the world, including a few hundred in the Balkans. But also to meet the academic requirements of depth and precision. The report is extremely extensive, more than 3,000 pages and another 4,000 of annexes. Also, because this was the only way of fulfilling the original request to create a reconstruction of the events that is as accurate and complete as possible at the time, and to provide an explanatory historical analysis. It was and is explicitly not the aim of the report to pass moral, political, let alone juridical judgment. The report was and is meant as a basis for public and other debate in which those moral, political, and juridical questions can be discussed and may be answered in the hope that the quality of the debate and the judgments will be higher than without the report. An English version of it, a full translation, is available on the internet, www.srebrenica.nl. It was clear from the beginning that the Srebrenica tragedy can only be understood in the context of former Yugoslavia's violent disintegration. It was there that the origins of the conflict could be found, and it was there that the readiness of nationalist leaders to resolve their differences by means of brute force developed, and it was there that the population's sense of insecurity and fear led to the acceptance of violence as the only means of defense. The report is very detailed about the actual course of the events and to its diverse backgrounds. In fact, the complicated dynamics of the historical process of its own is probably the most important explanatory factor. Thousands of individual and collective decisions and reactions on what was happening, each of which could have been different, make together the course of this story. What happened was not inevitable, although it makes no sense at all to speculate about what would have happened if. But for historical understanding, it is essential to keep in mind that in almost all circumstances, the future is not only unsure, but also in a way open. Constant attention for the conscious and unconscious dilemmas at the spot and at the moment on all levels is necessary. This also goes for the second important level of analysis, the international intervention. This intervention, in its specific form, played a significant part in the way the conflict developed. The interaction between the activities of the warring parties and the activities or absence of activities in the framework of the international intervention became decisive not only for the final outcome, but also for almost everything that happened during the process, the Srebrenica massacre being a shocking example. The role of the Dutch was relevant and understandable only in this framework and context of international intervention. This is not to deny the full responsibility of the Dutch actors. The report is full of what especially the Dutch did and analyses of what went wrong there, and Murphy's Law is applicable here. But today, for the sake of our panel discussion, I will concentrate on the level of the international intervention, more in particular, the early stages of the decision-making on that level. I will summarize the main findings of the report in this regard in the light of the relevance for the Srebrenica case, as well as in the light of some possible general tendencies in the processes of international intervention in the recent past. As the situation in Yugoslavia continued to develop to crisis level and the fear of violent conflict with far-reaching consequences grew, the rest of the world became increasingly concerned. Was intervention necessary and appropriate? And if so, how, by whom, and on what grounds? In general, three arguments are used to justify intervention of the type of internal conflict seen in Yugoslavia at the time. To prevent violations of human rights, to provide humanitarian aid where required, and to obviate any risk to world peace and stability. All three were relevant in this case. In practice, international interventions, whether primarily diplomatic, humanitarian, or military, are by nature precarious undertakings. There are always extremely complex issues involved, tied up in international politics and national problems, and every case has its own particularities. At the same time, law concerning interventions is very loosely framed. So each new conflict situation must be considered in a fresh light. The decision-making process within what we refer to as the international community are almost by definition slow and faltering. The governments and international organizations concerned have a marked tendency to wait and see, postponing any actual decisions as they carefully weigh up their own interests and determine their own positions. Intervention is therefore almost always reactive rather than proactive. Preventive action taken before major disruptions occur is very rare. Once the situation is clearly serious, The force of public opinion may impel governments to intervene on moral or humanitarian grounds. However, there is seldom any deeper analysis of the conflict. From the very beginning of an intervention, there are usually internal divisions, considerable restrictions, manipulations on the part of the combatant parties, compromises which often ignore the actual origins of the conflict, erroneous perceptions of the combatants, and so on. The intervention then takes on an improvisational trial and error character rather than a purposeful, targeted implementation of a careful planned program. An additional factor is that there is a general reluctance to deploy large number of troops, particularly where the risk of escalation is seen as high, with the danger of casualties among one's own countrymen. Without the intention of denigrating the efforts, the process can be characterized as muddling through. International involvement in the process surrounding Yugoslavia's dissolution in the early 90s clearly bore these characteristics. Muddling through was dominant until after the fall of Srebrenica. At first, the whole affair was seen to be a European problem, and indeed, Europe wished to deal with the problem of its own bed, so to say, in its own backyard. However, not only was the Balkans problem in itself very complex, the circumstances were very difficult too. Following the collapse of the Soviet Empire in the late 80s, the security system in Europe lacked direction. There was great uncertainty about the concepts of defense, about the role of the various organizations, and about the future of Europe itself. Europe's initial efforts with regards to the situation in Yugoslavia are a good example of the muddling through approach. Internal disagreements stood in the way of effective, concerted action. The manner in which the new states were accorded recognition, for instance, eventually forced through by Germany, clearly demonstrates this. As a result of the failure of Europe, the United Nations came to play an important part at a relatively early stage in the process. This was, after all, an appropriate institutional setting for intervention, having the necessary instruments of international law at his disposal. But there was hesitation here too. The Secretary General, Boutros Ghali, clearly had other priorities. He regarded worrying about problems in the Balkans as a Western preoccupation, which resulted in neglecting other, in his eyes, more serious problems elsewhere. Moreover, the United Nations faced a serious shortage of funds at this time. The United States could certainly have brought pressure by imposing conditions on the payment of outstanding contributions, but for reasons not to discuss here, they took a rather reticent stance for some time, particularly with regard to the deployment of ground troops. After lengthy and complex deliberations, the United Nations did indeed send troops to Bosnia, UNPROFOR, I mentioned it before. But this force was limited in size, had few physical resources, and was required to work on a very restricted and somewhat unclear mandate. Despite the lack of an overall strategy, there were significant activities on two other fronts. Numerous humanitarian aid organizations provided local assistance, and one of the main UNPROFOR's tasks became to facilitate these aid efforts. At the same time, various international negotiators were busy on the diplomatic front, devising and proposing various peace plans. The most significant of these plans was, of course, the Vance Owen peace plan in its various versions. It proved extremely difficult to have the combatant parties agree on any of these peace plans, for a long time there was no success in this regard. A significant obstacle was that there was clearly little international willingness to impose plans by means of military intervention. When the situation changed in the summer of 1995, it was finally proved possible to implement the Dayton Peace Agreement, which effectively ended the war in Bosnia. And as Michael Johnson said today, the question whether there was human rights involved is another question, of course. During the early days of the conflict, which began in 1992, the Bosnian Serbs and Serbia were able to claim military victories, partly due to the deployment of special troops from Serbia. Some 70% of the Bosnia-Herzegovina's territory was taken. The Serbs, however, were unable to take advantage of these military success when seated at the negotiation table at the time. This was largely due to the obstinate, unwavering attitude of the Bosnian Serbs. The Serbian president Milosevic had originally taken a very aggressive line, not the least with regard to Bosnia. However, during the diplomatic talks later in 1992, he appeared sensitive to the threat of sanctions and seemed prepared to give some ground. The Bosnian Serb president Karadzic was rather less willing to do so, and in practice, it was the diehard general Mladic who determined the position adopted by the Republika Srpska to torpedoing acceptance of the Vance Owen peace plans. The Bosnian Muslims were in a weaker military position, but were nevertheless unwilling to consider compromises. In fact, they wished to regain ground on the battlefield, and their long-term prospects for doing so were reasonably good. After all, it was questionable whether the Bosnian Serbs would have been able to maintain their very long and complex front lines for any length of time. Hardly surprising, the Bosnian Muslims deliberately sabotaged various rounds of negotiations, taking advantage of the fact that world opinion was largely on their side. One of the most obvious examples of an improvised response as part of a UN operation was the action taken in Srebrenica by the UNPROFOR commander Morillon in March 1993. Srebrenica was one of the few places in eastern Bosnia that the Muslims had managed to hold during the, from two sides, extremely violent fighting between Serbs and Muslims in 1992. In early 1993, the Bosnian Serbs renewed their efforts to take the town. The population, which by now was crowded with refugees, was in an extremely perilous situation. To make a gesture, and in an effort to dissuade the Bosnian Serbs from taking further action, Morillon decided to visit Srebrenica in person, accompanied only by a small escort party. The townspeople, restless and anxious, took Morillon hostage. He would not be released until firm guarantees were made with regard to the Muslim safety. In order to extricate himself from this awkward situation, Morillon declared to the people, in front of the press cameras, and hence the world at large, that Srebrenica was under the protection of the United Nations and that he would not abandon the population. By doing so, he created a fait accompli, which was translated by the United Nations Security Council into a decree which stated that Srebrenica was henceforth a safe area within Bosnia, in which an UNPROFOR unit would be permanently stationed. A Canadian battalion took up this position, this posting in April 1993. The concept of safe areas had already been raised in connection with the conflicts in former Yugoslavia, but it was a new and as yet undefined notion. The United Nations had a safe haven concept, but this would have required a great number of troops, a great, much greater number of troops than was actually available. In searching for ways forward despite the limited resources, based on the belief that something had to be done, the term safe area was coined. This remained a vague notion since it was a term sui generis, which, even when adopted in the resolutions of the Security Council, remained applicable only to Bosnia. However, it was clear that the so-called light interpretation of this option, which came to dominate, did not and could not provide full military protection of the designated safe area or its population. It was more of a gesture on the part of the international community, a warning not to attack. The presence of the United Nations troops would, it was hoped, deter any offensive action. To deter by presence was deliberately written down as the purpose. In that way, the designation of the safe area served also to provide the civilian population with a sense of security. As things turned out, any such sense of security was seriously misplaced. In the autumn of 1993, after much discussion, it was decided that the battalion, which the Dutch government had made available to UNPROFOR, would be sent to the safe area Srebrenica. This mission would, as we all know, 1 year and a half later, in July 1995, and the mission was officially ended before, to be more precise, end in disaster, resulting from a very complicated chain of interacting events, incident decisions, and so on several levels. As said earlier, this was not inevitable or determined before. The situation was open at almost all moments. Nevertheless, analyzing in hindsight, it was in a sense a logical or at least explainable outcome as well. The report's conclusion about the decision of the Dutch cabinet in 1993 is that Dutchbat was sent on a mission under very unfavorable conditions, of which at least three were the direct result of the decision-making muddling through process of international intervention. Dutchbat was sent to Srebrenica with an unclear mandate to a location described as a safe area, but without a clear definition of what this actually meant, to keep the peace where no peace existed. And I can add another series of situations which are not relevant for this moment because we should concentrate on the intervention. And I say that these three elements of this mission, conditions of this mission, are a relevant, a very good reason to discuss this subject today. Thank you for your attention.